content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Hello, this is Maureen McDonald for the North Carolina Reading Service. For the next half hour, I'll be reading to you from the May 2025 Walter Magazine. We begin with Flower Power, Cultivating Curiosity and a Closer Look with Painter Julia Einstein by Colony Little. You wouldn't think that a garden in the dead of winter could reveal much about itself, but even here, Julia Einstein can find inspiration for her botanical paintings. As she walks among the dormant garden beds at the Raleigh City Farm on a sunny February day, Einstein's keen eye spots signs of life in the ground cover below our feet. She kneels to pick up a tiny blue flower within a patch of Persian speedwell. It reminds her of a prop she brought to a December presentation at a Creative Mornings RDU, a monthly networking session over coffee and pastries where locals give empowering speeches. I used a magnifying glass because I wanted to talk about seeing things through the eyes of an artist, she says, twirling the flower in the bright morning sunlight. As an educator and artist, Einstein expresses her observations through paintings inspired by nature. Growing up in Mansfield, Massachusetts, she studied painting at the University of Massachusetts Amherst and spent her summers in Maine working and enjoying the beaches in the coastal town of Ogunquit. She later enrolled at the Rhode Island School of Design, earning a master's degree in education in 1991, where she developed her teaching style from mentors, including the former director of the program, Paul Sproul. He encouraged a philosophy of teaching that was built around the idea of an artist as teacher and teacher as artist, says Einstein. Einstein taught high school art for 11 years in Wareham, Massachusetts, where she took a multidisciplinary approach to teaching, introducing her students to diverse mediums and art forms, often by inviting other artists or faculty to stop by and give lectures. She later brought her educational expertise to the museum sector, working as a studio learning coordinator at the Portland Museum of Art and an educational experience coordinator at the Mass Art Art Museum. Her day job today is as a membership and marketing specialist at the North Carolina Museum of History. Now, it's all about engaging with visual culture, objects, and artifacts. That guides the work I do, she says. As I've grown as an educator, I've discovered a seamlessness between the creativity in my studio practice and in designing learning experiences. Einstein's painting practice revolves around objects in her physical space. Early paintings from her Window Portraits series, for example, were largely representational. Einstein painted interior spaces, capturing the architectural features of a windowsill in her home studio, or the way light entered a room at a particular angle at different times of day. Over time, she began to focus on other captivating design elements, like the details in the floral arrangements she placed around her home. The gestural qualities of the flowers became her fixation, taking inspiration from the shapes they create. It was the angle and the lines. Then it became the type of flowers or greenery that sort of echoed what was outside in the color or the landscape, says Einstein. Her most recent series, Flower Portraits, directs the viewer's eye toward the colorful blooms, an intersection of leggy stems crossing one another in a glass vase, or a slight bend of a wilting petal. There's a dynamism that encourages the viewer to imagine a breeze coming from a window that's just out of focus, coaxing these flowers into gentle movement. From this body of work, Einstein expanded her artistic aperture by creating floral portraits that focus on relationships between colors. In 2024, the artist created three large-scale paintings stemming from a series of small floral studies called Flower Power. One was exhibited at the Pullen Art Center as part of its Field Studies exhibition last summer. The other two were exhibited at the Stanley Whitman House in Connecticut in a show titled Motif, Museum as Studio. The works feature sinuous florals in shades of purple with blue leaves and rust-colored stems against a bright poison green backdrop. Einstein moved to Raleigh in 2021 to be closer to her son and family. Here, she's cultivated her educational approach to art through work at CAM Raleigh, Pullen Art Center, and a residency at the Raleigh City Farm, an idea that she herself pitched. In Massachusetts, Einstein had had a garden full of artistic muses, but moving to an apartment in the Warehouse District presented her with a challenge. No garden. "I wanted a space where I could pick flowers," she said. A friend steered Einstein to the nonprofit Urban Farm, and in 2022 she became the organization's first artist in residence, where she leads programming and artistic activities related to the seasonal plantings found in and around the farm. "Our partnership with Julia has benefited countless members of our community and deepened their appreciation for our diverse plant ecosystem," says Raleigh City Farm Executive Director Lisa Greelberry. She thoughtfully connects people and plants with creativity, respect, and joy. From leading printmaking workshops to hosting poetry readings to designing coloring activities, Einstein encourages guests and staff to experience the farm as an outdoor museum and visualize the land through the eyes of an artist. "It's about harnessing that passion that you have for it," Einstein says, citing the book Teaching in the Art Museum, Interpretation as Experience by Rika Burnham and Elliot Kai Key, which encourages setting up a playful environment for artwork. "I love play, and I love creativity." In March, she attended the Big Idea Learning event at Marbles Kids Museum, which brought leaders together to discuss ways to bring joy and learning to community engagement. "I left energized with a big smile on my face," says Einstein. "I enjoy learning new things, and I'm excited to see how that spark will be brought to a large scale in a new project." This article was edited for Time. From the sports department, team player, on the court and off, Tommy Burleson supported those around him, by A.J. Carr. The distant rumble in the small mountain town of Newland, North Carolina, in the late 1960s wasn't a tremor. It was the sound of college basketball coaches stampeding into an Avery County gym to watch Tommy Burleson, the 7'2" Newland Needle and highly ranked prep All-American, play at his high school. Intensely recruited by multiple schools and contacted by more than 300, Burleson said some even illegally offered him money to play. But he refused all pay, accepting only a scholarship that was allowed under NCAA rules and signing with North Carolina State University in 1970. It couldn't have worked out much better for Burleson or for State. He was the tallest player on a unique team featuring National Player of the Year David Thompson and talented contributors Tim Stoddard, Phil Spence, Mo Rivers, and Monty Tau. Together, they won 2 regular season and 2 conference tournament titles, went 27-0 in 1973, and capped their run in 1974 with a national championship and a 30-1 record. Playing before freshmen were eligible for varsity competition, Burleson maximized his opportunities as a three-year starter. He led the team in scoring once and rebounding three times, and produced double-double stats in scoring and rebounding each season. A team player and unselfish, he ranked second in assists as well. All that netted him lofty honors. All-America twice, All-Conference 3 years, ACC Tournament MVP two times, All-Final Four. Another accolade came from University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill coach Dean Smith, who said he was, quote, the most difficult player I ever had to prepare for, end quote. At NC State, Burleson was listed as 7 foot 4 inches, which was nettlesome for him. It was a stretch, and he thought it depicted him as a circus sideshow, when he was, in fact, a star player in a premier basketball show. His size was a plus, but not the biggest reason he succeeded. Coach Sloan was military, like my father. He was very strict, says Burleson. It was what I needed, and he instilled the team concept to play within the system. Burleson put in the extra work, often showing up an hour or more before practice, to refine his individual skills. Spurred on by the demanding Sloan and augmented by teammates, Burleson had a knack for delivering in the moments that mattered most. Rewind to 1974. After earning first-team All-ACC 2 seasons, he was voted second-team his senior year, behind Maryland's Len Elmore. That demise added fuel to Burleson's competitive fire. In a classic conference tournament championship game, he responded with a dominating 38-point, 13-rebound performance to win MVP honors and lead the Wolfpack to a victory when only the tourney champion qualified for the NCAA playoffs. In the following NCAA tournament, Burleson added more glitter to his resume. Going against UCLA great Bill Walton, he scored 20 points, grabbed 14 rebounds, and helped State end the Bruins' 7-year national championship reign in a double overtime thriller. 2 days later, the Pack conquered Marquette to win the title at a rocking Greensboro Coliseum. In the midst of his State career, Burleson was selected for the 1972 U.S. Olympic team, both an honor and horrifying experience, as that was the year that Palestinian militants attacked the Olympic Village in Munich, West Germany, and captured Israeli athletes. The U.S. also suffered its first ever Olympic basketball defeat, a controversial 1-point loss to the Soviet Union that still stings 53 years later. For Burleson, there would be 2 more seasons at State and a stint in the NBA. He earned all-rookie team honors and logged 7 years in the league before suffering a career-ending injury. After working a few years with Mountain Heritage Electrical and Lighting Supply, Burleson made a commitment to being a public servant. He was a 2-term county commissioner, then spent 28 years as planning inspections director, assisting land developers and helping keep buildings up to government standards. In the meantime, he and Thompson teamed up again to run a basketball camp, which they've been doing for 41 years. Burleson also became an ordained minister, a member of the Protestant Reformed Church, and now preaches periodically around the county. While ever busy, he plays some golf, makes time for family, and faithfully attends his 2 grandchildren's events. For all his good work, former North Carolina Governor Roy Cooper honored him with the Old North State Award in 2022, based on dedication and excellent service beyond expectations. Life hasn't been without hardship, however. He's among the multitude of mountain residents impacted by Hurricane Helene, which did tens of thousands of dollars in damage to his home. Making matters worse, he had a heart issue during that crisis, which meant he had to find an escape route out of his flooded area and travel to Winston-Salem for a procedure. Following a recovery period, Burleson returned to Newland, working again to help his devastated county. He donated money from his Christmas tree farm sales to pay bills for needy residents. He helped some displaced residents get temporary housing and helped others find jobs to support their families. Just as he had on the basketball court at NC State more than five decades ago, Burleson delivered for his community in the moments that mattered most. "That was God. It wasn't me," Burleson says. "He gave the resources." This article was edited for Time. Next up, for the birds. Joe Lapp has turned his four-acre Raleigh homestead into a sanctuary for purple martins, by Helen Yost. Purple martins are among the first migrating birds to arrive in our area, shimmering through the skies with their blue-black iridescent wings. Martins generally return from their winter home in Brazil in early March to the same colony site they used the year before, says Joe Lapp. Joe and his wife Andrea moved to Raleigh 36 years ago from a small western New York town called Leroy. They bought 4 acres in a mostly rural area along Yates Mill Pond Road to call home. "We liked the idea of country living and being reasonably close to Raleigh and Cary," says Joe. By 1990, Joe became interested in purple martins. "These birds are almost solely dependent on humans for housing," he says. Classified as native songbirds, the martins also have impressive songs and acrobatic skills. Joe knew that an established colony was close by when he saw the martins visiting his homestead, so he went to work on attracting the birds to his yard. It can take years to attract them, but he wasn't deterred. First step, creating homes for the birds. Purple martins are cavity dwellers, and in the wild, they seek natural cavities like woodpecker holes in tree snags. Today, with so much habitat loss, the birds are almost entirely reliant on man-made colonies. Joe designed his gourd racks after observing several others, using mostly materials from his property. He grew his first gourds using seeds he received from other martin landlords. Birdhouse gourds are vigorous vines that require sturdy support from a trellis or other structure. Joe leaves them on the vine well after the plant dies to dry out, so they aren't available for housing for a full year after planting. Once the gourds dry out, he preps them to work as houses by drilling holes for bird access, cleanup, nest checks, and ventilation. With the houses installed, Joe played the purple martin dawn song, a recording of boisterous males chirping at sunrise, for the entire month of March. "I'd place a boombox under the racks and turn it on when I went to work. Then Andrea picked it up on her way to work an hour later," he says. "It was exciting to have our first nesting pairs the first year we installed housing." Over 10 years, their feathered residence grew from one rack to an entire colony. "Now we have around 40 nesting pairs," says Joe. "They live within 3 racks of 16 houses. Most of the gourds are natural, but he has a few plastic gourds from Purple Martin Conservation Association in Erie, Pennsylvania. Plastic gourds are more expensive, around $30 each, and natural gourds are free but require a lot of prep. So far, the birds haven't shown a preference. In peak season, the martins have an average of 4 hatchlings raised in their nests. Joe is also an avid gardener. When he and Andrea bought the property, the previous owner had already established a small vegetable garden with a few fruit trees. The couple has continued to maintain and expand the garden. As their family grew, the Lapps installed an ever-changing landscape. Using granite scraps from local supply stores, they built raised beds to grow annual vegetables, including leafy greens, beets, sweet corn, melons, and more. The beds also host perennial crops, such as asparagus, blueberries, strawberries, and blackberries. Raised beds help control soil compaction, drainage, water runoff, and weeds, and they retain heat for a longer growing season. We try to grow fruits and vegetables that don't require pesticides, says Joe. Martins are aerial insectivores, meaning they hunt and eat insects in the air, feeding on dragonflies, deer flies, horseflies, and moths. I set out to attract the birds to eat unwanted insects from my vegetable garden, since I don't use pesticides, Joe says. Unfortunately, they feast on insects found 20 feet above the ground and not the mosquitoes and pests in my garden. Since retiring from his job as a secondary school math teacher 14 years ago, Joe has plenty of time to spend working his family's homestead and caring for his colony of purple martins. Even though he only has his feathered guests for a few months of the year. Once arriving at their summer colony here in Raleigh, the birds begin to mate. By the 1st of June, breeding ends as the last of their fledges leaves the nest. In July and August, purple martins move on to pre-migratory roost sites and prepare to head back to their wintering site in Brazil. That leaves the Lapps plenty of time to clean out the birdhouses, tend to the garden, and prep for their visitors anew. We are fortunate our neighbors love the martins too, says Joe. They especially love the morning and evening concerts from these songbirds. This article was edited for Time. And from the endnote, screen star. Severance actor Sarah Bach talks Growing Up in the Triangle by Rachel Simon. The second season of hit TV drama Severance may have left viewers with more questions than answers, but local residents can take comfort in having at least one big mystery solved. The identity of Miss Huang, the enigmatic young employee of Lumen Industries. The role is played by Sarah Bach, a talented 18-year-old who grew up in both Raleigh and Cary. Today, she's a student at Northwestern University, where she studies psychology and theater. I really didn't appreciate the seasons in North Carolina as much as I should have, Bach says. The winters here are a lot more intense. The actress spent her earliest years in Raleigh's Bedford neighborhood, before moving with her family to Cary. A trip up north to Broadway at age 8 sparked her interest in the performing arts, and so when Bach's mother, a librarian at Bach's Elementary School, spotted flyers advertising the Durant Road Musical Theater, she signed her daughter up to audition. It helped that the children's company was doing a production of Winnie the Pooh, Bach's then-favorite book. Bach ended up performing with the theater for the next 5 years before joining the North Carolina Theater Conservatory, Moonlight Stage Company, and North Carolina Dance Institute for more serious training as a teen. Especially in the Triangle, there are so many great opportunities for the arts, says Bach. For her, that included a regional production of Annie as a 12-year-old, her first professional role. I remember being so shocked that I booked it, Bach says, adding that she found out the news, much to her castmates' awe, while acting in her school's performance of Shrek Jr. Although fitting in Annie performances alongside her school schedule, along with an impressive side career training as a high-ranking youth tennis player, wasn't easy. Bach credits the hustle for giving her younger self, quote, a bit more confidence that, you know, maybe I can do this, end quote. Post-Annie, Bach quit tennis to focus on acting, with jobs ranging from small parts in indie films to voiceover work as Baby Shark. During her sophomore year at Green Level High School, her manager snagged her an audition for Severance, which had just concluded its Emmy-winning first season. I'd never gotten the opportunity to play with something so interesting before. It was uncharted waters for me, she says. She doubted she'd earn the part due to her limited on-screen experience, but something just clicked in the audition. Not long after, Bach moved to New York to start filming season 2. Due to the secrecy surrounding the show's plot and characters, Bach was instructed not to tell any of her peers that she'd earned a part in the show. They were all very excited for me, but a lot of them didn't know what I was doing until a couple months ago, says Bach. Once the show's second season premiered this January, the actress quickly earned praise for her performance. At Northwestern, she watched the new episodes alongside her college friends while taking part in campus theater productions. While she's gotten used to being recognized by strangers on her college campus, she's looking forward to coming home for the summer. I can't wait to be back in North Carolina, where I know a lot of people. It'll be a bit more normal, she says. Just don't ask Bach if she'll be back for more Severance. I genuinely know nothing about season 3, she promises. Looking at this month's calendar, North Hills Midtown Beach Music Series is back this year with its Thursday night summer concerts in the amphitheater. Grab food from nearby restaurants like Burgers and Fries from Five Guys or Tapas from Las Ramblas before unfolding your lawn chair or blankets to hear the music. Concerts are Thursday evenings from 6 to 9 p.m., and the May 29th concert features North Carolina ensemble Jim Quick and Coastline. We've run out of time for today's episode of Walter Magazine. Be sure to tune in next time. We hope you've enjoyed it. I'm Maureen McDonald for the North Carolina Reading Service. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Walter Magazine is available as a podcast at our website, ncreadingservice.org. If you have any comments or questions, call us at 919-832-5138. That number again is 919-832-5138. And thank you for listening to the North Carolina Reading Service.